Chapter 7. My works are well known. I am a young man in the yard line. You have seen my works many a time, though it's 50,000 to 1, if you have seen me. You say you don't want to see me? You say you're interested in my works, and not in me? Don't be too sure about that. Stop a bit. Let us have it down in black and white at the first go-off, so that there may be no unpleasantness or wrangling afterwards. And this is looked over by a friend of mine, a ticket writer, that is up to literature. I am a young man in the art line, in the fine art line. You have seen my works over and over again, and you have been curious about me, and you think you have seen me. Now, as a safe rule, you never have seen me, and you never do see me, and you never will see me. I think that's plainly put, and it's what knocks me over. If there's a blighted public character going, I am the party. It has been remarked by a certain or an uncertain philosopher that the world knows nothing of its greatest men. He might have put it plainer if he had thrown his eye in my direction. He might have put it that while the world knows something of them that apparently go in and win, it knows nothing of them that really go in and don't win. There it is again in another form, and that's what knocks me over. Not that it's only myself that suffers from injustice, but that I am more alive to my own injuries than to any other man's. Being, as I have mentioned, in the fine art line, and not the philanthropic line, I openly admit it. As to company and injury, I have company enough. Who are you passing every day at your competitive excruciations? The fortunate candidates whose heads and livers you have turned upside down for life? Not you. You are really passing the crammers and coaches. If your principle is right, why don't you turn out tomorrow morning with the keys of your cities on velvet cushions, your musicians playing, and your flags flying, and read addresses to the crammers and coaches on your bended knees, beseeching them to come out and govern you? Then, again, as to your public business of all sorts, your financial statements and your budgets, the public knows much, truly, about the real doers of all that. Your nobles and right honorables are first-rate men? Yes, and so is a goose a first-rate bird. But I'll tell you this about the goose. You will find his natural flavor disappointing, without stuffing. Perhaps I am soured by not being popular? But suppose I am popular. Suppose my works never fail to attract. Suppose that, whether they are exhibited by natural light or by artificial, they invariably draw the public. Then no doubt they are preserved in some collection? No, they are not. They are not preserved in any collection. Copyright? No, nor yet copyright. Anyhow, they must be somewhere? Wrong again, for they are often nowhere. Says you, at all events, you are in a moody state of mind, my friend. My answer is, I have described myself as a public character with a blight upon him which fully accounts for the curdling of the milk in that cocoa nut. Those that are acquainted with London are aware of a locality on the Surrey side of the River Thames, called the Obelisk, or, more generally, the Obstacle. Those that are not acquainted with London will also be aware of it, now that I have named it. My lodging is not far from that locality. I am a young man of that easy disposition, that I lie abed till it's absolutely necessary to get up and earn something, and then I lie abed again till I have spent it. It was on an occasion, when I had had to turn to with a view to victuals, that I found myself walking along the Waterloo Road, one evening after dark, accompanied by an acquaintance and fellow lodger in the gas-fitting way of life. He is very good company, having worked at the theaters, and, indeed, he has a theatrical turn himself, and wishes to be brought out in the character of Othello. But whether on account of his regular work always blacking his face and hands more or less, I cannot say. Tom, he says, what a mystery hangs over you. Yes, Mr. Click, the rest of the house generally give him his name, as being first, front, carpeted all over, his own furniture, and if not mahogany, an out-and-out imitation. Yes, Mr. Click, a mystery does hang over me. Makes you low, you see, don't it? Says he, eyeing me sideways. Why, yes, Mr. Click, there are circumstances connected with it that have, I yielded to a sigh, a lowering effect. Gives you a touch of the misanthrope too, don't it? Says he. Well, I'll tell you what. If I was you, I'd shake it off. If I was you, I would, Mr. Click. But, if you was me, you wouldn't. Ah. Says he, there's something in that. When we had walked a little further, he took it up again, by touching me on the chest. You see, Tom, it seems to me as if, in the words of the poet who wrote the domestic drama of The Stranger, you had a silent sorrow there. I have, Mr. Click. I hope, Tom, lowering his voice in a friendly way, it isn't coining, or smashing. No, Mr. Click. Don't be uneasy. Nor yet for Mr. Click checked himself, and added, counterfeiting anything, for instance? No, Mr. Click. I am lawfully in the art line, fine art line, but I can say no more. Ah, under a species of star? A kind of malignant spell? A sort of a gloomy destiny? A cankerworm pegging away at your vitals in secret, as well as I make it out? Said Mr. Click, eyeing me with some admiration. I told Mr. Click that was about it, if we came to particulars, and I thought he appeared rather proud of me. Our conversation had brought us to a crowd of people, the greater part struggling for a front place from which to see something on the pavement, which proved to be various designs executed in colored chalks on the pavement stones, lighted by two candles stuck in mud sconces. The subjects consisted of a fine fresh salmon's head and shoulders, supposed to have been recently sent home from the fishmongers. A moonlight night at sea in a circle, dead game, scroll work, the head of a hoary hermit engaged in devout contemplation, the head of a pointer smoking a pipe, and a cherubim, his flesh creased as in infancy, going on a horizontal errand against the wind. All these subjects appeared to me to be exquisitely done. On his knees on one side of this gallery, a shabby person of modest appearance who shivered dreadfully though it wasn't at all cold, was engaged in blowing the chalk dust off the moon, toning the outline of the back of the hermit's head with a bit of leather, and fattening the downstroke of a letter or two in the writing. I have forgotten to mention that writing formed a part of the composition, and that it also, as it appeared to me, was exquisitely done. It ran as follows, in fine round characters. An honest man is the noblest work of God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0. Pounds SD employment in an office is humbly requested. Honor the Queen. Hunger is a 0987654321 sharp thorn. Chip chop, cherry chop, folder older I do. Astronomy and mathematics. I do this to support my family. Murmurs of admiration at the exceeding beauty of this performance went about among the crowd. The artist, having finished his touching and having spoilt those places, took his seat on the pavement, with his knees crouched up very nigh his chin, and halfpence began to rattle in. A pity to see a man of that talent brought so low, ain't it? Said one of the crowd to me. What he might have done in the coach painting, or house decorating, said another man, who took up the first speaker, because I did not. Why, he writes alone like the Lord Chancellor, said another man. Better, said another. I know his writing. He couldn't support his family this way. Then, a woman noticed the natural fluffiness of the hermit's hair, and another woman, her friend, mentioned of the salmon's gills, that you could almost see him gasp. Then, an elderly country gentleman stepped forward, and asked the modest man, how he executed his work. And the modest man took some scraps of brown paper with colors, in them out of his pockets, and showed them. Then a fair-complexioned donkey, with sandy hair and spectacles, asked if the hermit was a portrait? To which the modest man, casting a sorrowful glance upon it, replied that it was, to a certain extent, a recollection of his father. This caused a boy to yelp out, "Is the pine tree smoking the pipe, your mother?" who was immediately shoved out of view by a sympathetic carpenter with his basket of tools at his back. At every fresh question or remark, the crowd leaned forward more eagerly, and dropped the halfpence more freely, and the modest man gathered them up more meekly. At last, another elderly gentleman came to the front, and gave the artist his card, to come to his office tomorrow, and get some copying to do. The card was accompanied by sixpence, and the artist was profoundly grateful, and, before he put the card in his hat, read it several times by the light of his candles, to fix the address well in his mind, in case he should lose it. The crowd was deeply interested by this last incident, and a man in the second row with a gruff voice growled to the artist, "You've got a chance in life now, ain't you?" The artist answered, sniffing in a very low-spirited way, "However, I'm thankful to hope so." Upon which there was a general chorus of "you are all right," and the halfpence slackened very decidedly. I felt myself pulled away by the arm, and Mr. Click and I stood alone at the corner of the next crossing. "Why, Tom," said Mr. Click, "what a horrid expression of face you've got." "Have I?" says one. "Have you?" says Mr. Click. "Why, you looked as if you would have his blood."
"Whose blood?"
"The artist's."
"The artist's?"
I repeated. And I laughed, frantically, wildly, gloomily, incoherently, disagreeably. I am sensible that I did. I know I did. Mr. Click stared at me in a scared sort of a way, but said nothing until we had walked a street's length. He then stopped short, and said, with excitement on the part of his forefinger, "Thomas, I find it necessary to be plain with you. I don't like the envious man. I have identified the cankerworm that's pegging away at your vitals, and it's envy, Thomas."
"Is it?" says one.
"Yes, it is," says B. "Thomas, beware of envy. It is the green-eyed monster which never did, and never will improve each shining hour, but quite the reverse. I dread the envious man, Thomas. I confess that I am afraid of the envious man, when he is so envious as you are. Whilst you contemplated the works of a gifted rival, and whilst you heard that rival's praises, and especially whilst you met his humble glance as he put that card away, your countenance was so malevolent as to be terrific. Thomas, I have heard of the envy of them that follows the fine art line, but I never believed it could be what yours is. I wish you well, but I take my leave of you. And if you should ever got into trouble through knifing or say, garroting a brother artist, as I believe you will, don't call me to character, Thomas, or I shall be forced to injure your case." Mr. Click parted from me with those words, and we broke off our acquaintance. I became enamored. Her name was Henrietta. Contending with my easy disposition, I frequently got up to go after her. She also dwelt in the neighborhood of the obstacle, and I did fondly hope that no other would interpose in the way of our union. To say that Henrietta was volatile is but to say that she was woman. To say that she was in the bonnet trimming is feebly to express the taste which reigned predominant in her own. She consented to walk with me. Let me do her the justice to say that she did so upon trial. "I am not," said Henrietta, "as yet prepared to regard you, Thomas, in any other light than as a friend, but as a friend I am willing to walk with you, on the understanding that softer sentiments may flow." We walked. Under the influence of Henrietta's beguilements, I now got out of bed daily. I pursued my calling with an industry before unknown, and it cannot fail to have been observed at that period, by those most familiar with the streets of London, that there was a larger supply. But hold! The time is not yet come. One evening in October I was walking with Henrietta, enjoying the cool breezes wafted over Vauxhall Bridge. After several slow turns, Henrietta gaped frequently, so inseparable from woman is the love of excitement, and said, "Let's go home by Grosvenor Place, Piccadilly, and Waterloo localities. I may state for the information of the stranger and the foreigner, well known in London, and the last day bridge.
No, not by Piccadilly, Henrietta, said one.
And why not Piccadilly, for goodness' sake? Said Henrietta.
Could I tell her? Could I confess to the gloomy presentiment that overshadowed me? Could I make myself intelligible to her?
No. I don't like Piccadilly, Henrietta.
But I do, said she.
It's dark now, and the long rows of lamps in Piccadilly after dark are beautiful.
I will go to Piccadilly.
Of course we went. It was a pleasant night, and there were numbers of people in the streets.
It was a brisk night, but not too cold, and not damp.
Let me darkly observe, it was the best of all nights for the purpose.
As we passed the garden wall of the royal palace, going up Grosvenor Place, Henrietta murmured.
I wish I was a queen.
Why so, Henrietta?
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.